Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 21st, 2005. This is your host, Stephen Novella, President of the New England Skeptical Society. With me tonight are Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
Perry DeAngelis.
Good evening.
And Bob Novella.
Hello.
So the news today, the big news this week, is victory in Dover.
Yay!
Woohoo!
Judge John Jones handed down a 139-page decision, and this is the case, the name of the case is Tammy Kitzmiller et al. Versus the Dover Area School District. This was regarding the teaching of intelligent design we've been talking about over the last few months. So this was the eagerly awaited decision. I don't think there was really much doubt, at least not in my mind, that the judge was going to decide against the school district, basically ruling that teaching of intelligent design in the public schools is unconstitutional. The real question was how broad or narrow his decision was going to be. Well, I've perused a lot of the 139-page decision. I got to tell you, this judge did not leave a stone unturned. This was, I think, the broadest decision we could have hoped for.
I wonder what kind of help he had. I mean, I guess, you know, going through a court case like that, you probably, you know, I'm sure you end up well-versed in the topic, but I wonder what outside sources he approached in coming up with this. I mean, he didn't write this 139-page himself, did he? I mean, did he? I'm sure he's got guys that, you know,
well, him
that,
and his clerks,
that
I mean,
sum up everything. I mean,
yeah, he has staff. You know, he had 6 weeks of testimony.
Right.
He had a lot of precedents, you know, a lot of cases that he was summarizing. He actually took the time to go through the history of creationism in this country and the history of the legal cases. So a lot of it was material he would have had available to him. And then the rest is commenting specifically on testimony that was given before him.
Right, right. Which is what he should do. He should base his decision on the case presented to him.
So a few things that struck me reading through, actually many things, but some things that I think are very significant. The judge, again, I think was trying to really establish an ironclad decision here that cannot be circumvented. He commented specifically on the fact that ID, intelligent design, has historical connections to creationism. And multiple times in the decision, he wrote that, you know, a reasonable person assessing this, understanding the cultural and historical context. So he very, very specifically was putting intelligent design into its historical context, saying, you know, again, tying it to its religious antecedents. There were some specific pieces of information he cited, for example, the Of Pandas and People book that was specifically referred to in the Dover law, basically saying that you have to teach intelligent design in the public schools. There were multiple drafts of this book available, and one draft, earlier drafts, used the word creationism, you know, I think 150 times, and the final draft essentially was a search and replaced the word creationism with the word intelligent design.
And not only that, the timing was significant, when it was changed.
And that occurred right after the legal case that basically said that creationism could not be taught in public schools. So they said, okay, well, let's just change the word creationism for intelligent design and try again.
And also, Steve, I'm not sure if you're aware, the circumstances under which the book got into the school was very, very shady. It was kind of like laundered in a sense, was the description that I read, where somebody involved, you know, he had somebody buy the book and give it to the school or something. It was, a little underhanded.
It was very contrived.
Yeah.
So if you may recall, guys, when Chris Mooney was on the show, we were talking about this topic, as he had been covering, from a journalistic point of view, had been covering the trial. He noted that one concern is that, you know, where are the creationists going to go next? It's assuming they lose this fight, which they did. What's their next move?
Well, I didn't even think of that yet.
And his concern was that, well, what if they just try to mandate a criticism of evolution, teaching the gaps and the flaws in evolutionary theory?
Go right ahead.
But not promoting the teaching of intelligent design or anything that could be overtly religious. Well, the judge in this case, Judge Jones, actually already kind of addressed that issue And he said that, you know, specifically mandating teaching about, you know, the gaps or flaws in evolution only serves a religious purpose. And he again made that historical connection to creationism. It is a strategy employed by creationists, and that was enough to link it to creationism. So he was that I was very heartened by that. He's basically saying that, you know, the creationists can't just keep morphing their strategy from A to B to C to D and think that they're starting with a clean slate each time. That basically they're not fooling anyone. Whatever it morphs into next is still creationism. Because, you know, and the law, the judge in this case said it is perfectly legitimate legalistically to put whatever it morphs into its historical context. So that's good. I mean, it's
very astute.
Yeah, however you try to play the game, we have your number, and it's not going to work.
Excellent. I've got a little clip here from his argument, from his paper, and the part of this that I really focused on and I was really interested in is the fact that it's just so not science. It's pathetic. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how hard can it really be to say, look, this is not science, therefore, regardless of anything else, it doesn't belong in the classroom. And he's got 3 points here. See, ID violates the centuries-old ground rules of science by invoking and permitting supernatural causation.
Right.
That's a biggie. That's kind of important right there. The second one is the argument of irreducible complexity central to intelligent design employs the same flawed and illogical contrived dualism that doomed creation science in the 80s.
Right.
And this next one ties into what you recently said, Steve. Intelligent design's negative attacks on evolution have been refuted by the scientific community. That's it. I mean, all this negative stuff you're saying about evolution, I mean, it's not one scientific theory against another. The scientific community unilaterally has said wrong. This stuff is just not true.
That's right. I think in the part of his decision, he specifically mentioned the testimony regarding Behe's favorite example, the flagellum, who says is irreducibly complex. He said, and yet, you know, scientists gave testimony that in the 5 years or 6 years since Behe first proposed that example, that much more of the evolution of the flagellum, and I think also the immune system has been fleshed out. So the fact, his claim that it's irreducibly complex has been proven false since he made those claims. I mean, new research has been done to show that. I mean, so
and he knows that. Come on, you know,
he does,
knows that.
And which pegs him as being disingenuous, which the judge was very scathing about the ID proponents, basically saying that they were not sincere in their position.
To say the least, that's what he said, yes.
Right. I've got some other interesting pullouts here that I've gleaned.
Well, before we move on, I wanted to just comment on some of the things that you brought up, some of the points. For example, the supernatural aspect of intelligent design, and the judge spent a lot of time writing about that. And that's critical also because, you know, as we've said before, the intelligent design proponents are not simply presenting intelligent design as science. They are trying to redefine science to include supernatural explanations. And the judge spent a lot of time addressing that specific point. First of all, he pointed out that every single ID defendant in the case admitted that there is no intelligent design without a supernaturalism. It therefore does not meet the conventional definition of science. They admitted it. And then he explained very carefully why supernaturalism equals religion and why it is not admissible in the halls of science. The two are incompatible. So he very specifically made that decision. So, and again, of course, this is absolutely critical to this whole debate. And, again, as we discussed before, you can't change the rules of science. They are the way they are by necessity.
That was the most egregious thing,
the
fact that they were even attempting to redefine science. Steve, there's another thing. The judge asked a lot of the board members, he asked them about intelligent design, and almost all of them didn't even really know any details. They couldn't even describe it to the judge, and he was so taken aback by that. The best that one member said to him was that it's, you know, things are designed intelligently. And that's, I mean, these people, talk
yeah,
about
that is intelligent design.
Talk about sheep. I mean, just like, you do this and say this, okay. My God, they didn't even bother, even months later, bother to study up on intelligent design so that they can, you know, talk intelligently about it in court.
They didn't even do their homework before court.
They apparently totally underestimated the judge.
Or overestimated their counsel.
So I imagine there has been an interesting response from the ID proponents after such a scathing and devastating decision against them.
Yeah, I've been looking for some responses. There's been some, but and I assume in the future it'll start coming out as to what they want to do. A couple things I got here is one of the guys at the Discovery Institute, John West, the senior fellow, said that Judge Jones got on his soapbox to offer his own views of science, religion, and evolution. He makes it clear that he wants his place in history as the judge who issued a definitive decision about intelligent design. This is an activist judge who has delusions of grandeur. Now, obviously, he didn't read, you know, he didn't read the judge's paper, but I mean, he made a point of saying, I am not an activist judge, and this is not an activist bench. And just look at, you know, the past decisions he's made, and that's just not what he is.
Yeah, he's a conservative judge who's actually a G.W. Bush appointee, by the way, who's religious. The judge
really,
He says he's not an activist judge. Said the school board that tried to impose their religious views on a public school system, they were being activist and they overstepped their bounds, and they did not serve the public well. And he was absolutely right. I mean, of course, the Discovery Institute and the ID proponents are going to be crying like babies about this decision, but they have nothing to say. He's trying to redefine science. Hello? They're the ones who are trying to redefine science. He had centuries of precedence to establish the separation of supernaturalism from natural causes in science. Centuries of precedence, basically since the dawn of science. That is the division between science and religion.
Right.
So it just tells you how vacuous and just intellectually dishonest their position is.
It is. And here's another one. Richard Thompson, the lawyer for the Dover Area School, said that this judge should not place himself in the position of determining which scientific theory is valid and which is not. That's the first part of his quote, which is just so ridiculous, because that statement assumes that you've got two, you know, scientific theories when, sorry, one of them is not a scientific theory.
The premise is wrong,
right,
and the conclusion is wrong. The other premise there is that judges don't decide the validity of science in the courtroom. Of course they do. They do that every day. They hear expert testimony and they decide which scientific testimony is legitimate. The judge painstakingly went through all of the testimony on both sides and showed on every single point the plaintiff's expert witnesses, you know, the defenders of evolution and science, absolutely crushed the ID proponents, who just committed logical fallacy after logical fallacy.
Right.
The fact is, when you're in a court of law, when there are rules of evidence and logic, and you are dealing with people who are experts in logic, lawyers are, if nothing else, experts in logic. That is their skill. That is what they do. You can't get away with anything. And the judge saw through every single one of their misdirections, every single one of their illogical statements. And that's it. They were called on it. And this is what's happened
time and again
in every single creationism case that has, you know, gotten to the high courts, is that, you know, under the rules of evidence of a courtroom, the creationist argument falls into like the tissue paper that it's made of.
Here's another one from Richard Thompson, the lawyer. He said it should be left up to the debate that the scientific community was involved with. He's leaving it to the scientific community. Hello, I think they already made their decision. I mean, there is no debate within the scientific community.
Right. The scientific community is united in their position that ID is not science. And again, they're trying desperately to portray this as a debate between two different scientific ideas. Again, the premise is wrong. ID is not science. Again, the judge very clearly explained exactly why that is. It fails the test for science in multiple ways. One, it allows supernatural explanations. Two, it's not testable. And he asked that question of Behe and the others, who the ID experts in the case. Tell me a way in which intelligent design can be subjected to a scientific test. And everything that they proposed, he said, was actually really just a test of evolution, not a test of ID. And again, they were falling back on this false dualism, saying that if it's not evolution, then ID, which is a which is the false dichotomy, logical fallacy. And therefore, they were misinterpreting or misrepresenting scientific tests of evolution as if they were tests of intelligent design. In fact, there are no possible tests of intelligent design because it's not a scientific theory. Interestingly, just as we're wrapping up this topic, 2 days ago, so the day before the Dover decision, there was an article, an editorial published by one-time presidential candidate and political commentator Pat Buchanan. Now, Buchanan has a reputation for being a bit of a political maverick, but here the name of his article was Darwinism on Defense, and it's basically an attack of evolution. Now,
good timing with this article.
It was good timing, right? But interestingly, Buchanan, who was otherwise, even if you disagree with his politics, and he is on the fringe in a lot of issues. But even if you disagree with him, he usually is pretty careful about how he formulates his arguments and tries to avoid overt factual misstatements. But now he's stepping into the arena of the evolution creation debate, and he dredges up arguments that have been destroyed 30, 40 years ago. He clearly knows nothing about this topic. Let me give you a couple of examples that I thought were just so egregious, really do him a great disservice. He basically reiterates the old argument that survival of the fittest is a tautology because those who survive are defined as those who are the fittest, and those who are the fittest are defined as those who survive, which is absurd. Those who are fittest are the ones who could run the fastest, reproduce the best, who have those list of traits which enable them to survive and reproduce. That's what makes them the fittest, and that's what enables them to survive. So it's not a tautology. That's just a really silly argument that has been destroyed decades ago. And he's dredging it up as if this is some kind of a new concept.
And here's another one. He asks here, or he states here, and there are gaps in human evolution. Where are the missing links between lower and higher forms? Says, come on. I mean, where's he... where's he getting his playbook from, 30-year-old creationist texts?
100 years.
He must be. I mean, there are no transitional forms. Please, how about there are transitional forms between, whales and terrestrial mammals, Ambulocetus. Where was he when that was discovered? How about there are now dozens of feathered dinosaurs that are clearly occupying a morphological zone between dinosaurs and modern birds. He says there's no missing link between apes and man. So, come on, how about Australopithecus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus? I mean, there's basically a nice sequence of transitional forms. Again, it's not strictly linear. Evolution tends to branch out. It's bushy, as Stephen Jay Gould used to say.
Definitely,
but still, it represents an evolutionary, a nice, intricate, vast evolutionary connection between modern man, Homo sapiens, and our ape relatives. It's there. I mean, go to a museum. I mean,
Steve, it's interesting that you point out at the beginning of this segment that Pat Buchanan normally, regardless of what you think of his politics, is normally a careful thinker and constructs his arguments with thought. But when you get into these subjects, he's obviously invested. He's emotional about it, and his critical tools fall by the wayside. It's obvious by what he wrote.
Right. I mean, he basically did a hack job in that article, which is just different than his usual writing.
Right, because he let his emotions get away with him. He needs this to be true.
Well, let's all savor this moment. This was a stunning, definitive victory for evolution
miracle.
And for science and for our society. really put the intelligent design on the ropes.
I want to see this in the Supreme Court.
That would be nice, but this is still a federal district court.
It is.
A high
great,
court.
But
this
man,
this
I
is
want
still
precedent.
It may not be definitive law nationally like a Supreme Court decision would, but it is still a very powerful precedent.
It is a very powerful precedent, and he went above and beyond.
He did.
He was merciless on the ID side.
It was a great way to end 2005, I think. Yeah,
kudos to Judge John Jones.
Well done, Judge.
Here, 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 here.
Okay, so joining us now is Jan Helen McGee. Jan Helen, as she tells us she likes to be called, was involved recently in a murder investigation. She is a psychic detective who investigated the case of the murderer of Mark Arnold. The murder occurred in 1993. She assisted Detective Paul Zechman in the case, and according to newspaper reports, etc., provided the probable location of the murderer, who was then found. The murderer was Robert Weiss. So, Jan Helen, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us and agreeing to be confronted by four skeptics.
You're pretty good with the Helen part, too, because Helen, my middle name, is the name that I've always used when I work on these cases. It's only recently that I've decided to talk about my involvement. It's always been a secret. So the only police officer or detective that knew my real name was my direct link. The rest of the detectives that were working on the case only knew me as Helen.
I see. Well, why don't you tell us about this case? Just start from the beginning and tell us how you got involved.
Well, I had worked very peripherally on a case prior to this with some detectives in my town, Lebanon, Pennsylvania, another murder in Palmyra. And this was the first big case I worked on. What happened was I had a dream. Frankly, my whole life I've had murder dreams. I didn't connect them with actual murders until it became quite clear in 1993. That night, before I started working on the case, I had a really scary dream, and I woke up my then husband and told him about the dream. Well, frankly, he woke up because I gasped from the fear that I had about the dream because I saw the actual murder. I told him the whole story of the dream and the murder, went back to sleep, and then in the morning, I had this strong desire to go get a newspaper, which is something that I never did, drive to go get a paper. So I did, and when I picked up the paper, there on the front page was a picture of the building, and it was just a one-room shack-type building, and it was exactly like in my dream. I brought it home, and everything in the article was exactly as I had described it in the dream. And my husband at the time just kept pushing me. He said, you have to call the police. You can't. You don't have another choice. So I made a call to the local county detectives and told him the things from the dream and then some other information. Then I went on my computer and typed up some added information, some thoughts that I had, and sent those to him. After that, I went into his office and talked to him. Then we sort of both decided that I would go to the site, to the murder site, and see if I had any more insights. So then one Saturday morning, I went in to meet them at the municipal building, and the chief county detective, Paul Zechman, took me into a room that was just filled with detectives, maybe between five and eight of them, because what they were doing that day was they had decided to close down the site. You know, the site had been open for several weeks since this was a few weeks after the murder. That this happened, and they were doing their very last collection. Somebody was coming down from Harrisburg to do some blood collection, and they were forensic people. This was like the last of the forensic, the last time to go on the site before they released it back to the owner. So I got in there into that room, and there were all these detectives, and they were very, very unhappy because they had to work early. It was like 7:30 on a Saturday morning, and they also weren't very happy to see me.
Did they get many murders in that town, or was this maybe a first for them?
No, there's murders in this town. I think it's a town of 30,000, so there's a murder every year. You know, it doesn't have a high crime rate, but it doesn't have a real low crime rate. The city itself, even though I live in the county, the city itself has some trouble. So they weren't totally new to it, but I would say it's a pretty safe town, relatively safe, small town outside of Harrisburg. So I was in that room, and Paul Zechman said, okay, Helen, tell everybody what you told me. And then he left me in that room. So I just sat down, and I proceeded to tell the other detectives what I felt I knew about the case. One of the things that I was obsessed with that really had no meaning on the case necessarily, but seemed very, very important to me, and it was sort of it was a pathway, I think. So I guess in retrospect it's a little bit important because it led me down a path. But one thing I saw in this one room building was that the victim had over 25 black rotary phones, those phones from the 40s. And I just couldn't believe it. And I just kept talking about these phones. And then finally I realized that only one of the phones was hooked up, that he talked constantly. He sat at his desk and he talked constantly on the phone. And then I sort of got to the point where I felt that he was talking to his best friend on the phone, and then that's how I reached the conclusion that his best friend had killed him.
Mm-hmm. What was the significance of the black rotary phone in the actual case?
Well, there really wasn't any. I mean, after I told the detectives in the rooms the things I knew, then we all packed up and went out to the site, and it was snowing. There was some snow in the ground, and everybody was just sort of milling around, and I was just walking around. One of the other detectives insisted that I look inside this building, and I really didn't want to because it just sounds so bizarre, but when I saw the murder, and this isn't just in my dream because I remember very little of my dreams, but when I see these murders, I sometimes switch from the victim to the killer, and then sometimes I sort of float. So when I saw this all happening, I was sort of, this just sounds so bizarre, I was sort of floating above the floor as I watched it. And it makes me feel physically ill when I go through these scenes and work on these cases. So I really didn't want to revisit that part. I felt I had told enough of it, but this one detective just insisted I look in there. Before I looked in, another thing that I knew about was that these two men had shared a meal together before the one killed the other. And so when he opened the door and I looked inside the one room building, I was quite shocked myself because I didn't know that I was really, I didn't have a clue that I was good at this. I just was driven to share my information. And when I looked in there, there were over 20. I've never seen so many black rotary phones. They were everywhere. They were on the chair. This was sort of a messy place. They were on the chair. They were on the counter. They were on the bookshelf. They were on every available surface had a black rotary phone. And then to the left was the desk that I had envisioned and the phone that was actually working. And then it was really creepy for me because I looked over to the stove. There was a stove in there, and on the stove was a big pan with congealed meat.
Now, you mentioned that you don't remember much of your dreams, but that you relive the murder in a vision. So this is a waking vision that you get?
Yes, the best way I can describe it to people, because a lot of people always want to know how do I see things. To me, it's like a memory. Say, for example, you're in the grocery store and you see someone and they ring a bell. You say, I think I know that person, but I don't know how or who they are. And then you walk maybe around to the next aisle and all of a sudden you start realizing that that person went to school with you. And then you go down another pathway of memory that says, oh, that's right, it was middle school. And then the next path might be, oh, it was Mrs. Jackson's room. And then suddenly you realize it was art class. You can see the, even though it might be 20, 30 years ago, the memory just comes at you like it was yesterday. You can smell the room. You can see who's sitting next to you. You can remember the nervous habits of Mrs. Jackson. And then it, and then just the whole room opens up. So to me, it's just like a memory. I go back a pathway sometimes. I mean, sometimes things come very clearly. In this case, even though I was obsessed with the fact that after this man killed his friend, he went outside and smoked a cigarette, tried to figure out what he was going to do, and then decided to steal his friend's identity because he wanted to be his friend. But then I remember that I was standing, they were ready to close up the site, and I was just standing there with Paul Zechman, and suddenly he said, where did he go? And that's when I told him that he went to the beach. So to me, it's not only my visions, if you want to call them, but also other people's interpretations of what I say. Because I really think that in any kind of murder case, there are teams. And I feel like I was an important part of this team, but just a part of the team nonetheless, just one puzzle piece. A puzzle can't be put together without lots of pieces, and I was one puzzle piece. If he hadn't asked me where he went, I might not even have mentioned that.
But until he asked that question, had you had any visions about where he went after the murder?
No, because I was just, I was so upset that he killed his best friend. And then it's just not very pleasant, but I become the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And I see their reasoning. And I find them I sort of get on their side, as awful as it sounds. And the killer wanted to be the victim. As messed up as that sounds, he wanted to be his best friend. He adored his family. He was divorced, but his ex-wife, the victim's ex-wife, was very, very solicitous towards him, took care of him, checked in on him. He had a lovely son. The killer wanted his son. He wanted his family. He wanted his life. He ended up stealing his car. I found out later he stole his car, he stole his wallet, he stole his whole identity. And so I was obsessed with them being best friends. I mean, I could hardly get past the fact that you would have a lovely meal with your best friend and then he would just kill you. So without Paul's question, I don't know if I ever would have gone there.
Right. But when he asked the question, I mean, did you have a vision at that moment, or was this the information was with you already?
It just came right out of my mouth. No, I hadn't even thought about it. It just came right out of my mouth. I said, he's at the beach. And then I just thought it was so bizarre because there was snow all over the ground. Who would go to the beach in the snow? And then I could see that he had gone to the beach when he was a child, and this was a safe place for him. So I told Paul that I didn't think he was at the Jersey Beach. Now, here in this town, when people vacation, they always go to the New Jersey Beach.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the first thought. I said, he's definitely not at the New Jersey Beach, but I thought it was either Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, or Ocean City, Maryland. And then I realized he was definitely there.
At one of those two places?
Yeah, and then I said, are they close? And Paul said, they're sort of close. Because I can't, when I do this work, I become very right-brained, and I have to sort of float. It's like I'm a musician, I'm a music teacher, and when I play music and really want to interpret it properly, I have to get into my right-brain activity, and I have to act sort of floaty. And that's the same thing that I have to do here. So my any left-brain activity sort of leaves me. So there's lots of things I don't quite get when I'm doing, working on cases.
I see. So you're not good with directions when you're in this state?
No, I don't even like driving. I don't like being in charge of anything. I just like to sort of just let myself go like you do when you're falling asleep, sort of.
Now, is this something you've always been able to do? Say when you were a little girl?
Sure. The first memory I have is I lived in a row house up until I was 2, so this was before I was 2 years old. I remember waking up in my crib and standing up and feeling the urge to cry for my mother. But then I remember being able to see through the walls and see through the floor and see where she was in the house so that I didn't have to cry, because I knew that she was in the house with me and I didn't have to be afraid and that she would come. Then the next memory that I have is I must have been about kindergarten age, because I remember the sequence was that I asked my mother if I could go in the front yard alone. She'd let me in the backyard alone, but not in the front yard because it was a busy street out front. And then I remember she finally decided that I was old enough. So maybe I was even 6, but probably 5, because I remember I walked to school alone in first grade when I was 6. So I was probably kindergarten age. And she let me go in the front yard. And I used to go behind this big, big, fat tree that I could completely hide behind. And I would move around the tree and stare at the neighbors. And I remember that I could see through the tree and see through their walls and watch what they were doing. And we had ladies that were widows, and 3 of them were widows, and they really led a pretty boring life, so I didn't really like watching them. But mm-hmm. right next door to us was a family that was totally out of control. And so mostly I would go in the front, and in retrospect, it seems so odd, but I would stand there with my back to the tree, but I would look back through the tree and so that I could sort of lean against the tree and my face didn't have to be against a tree. And so I could look back through the tree and through the house, and the mother would always be screaming, and she would throw herself on the stairs and cry, and then the husband would come down the steps and he'd yell, and then he'd slam the door and go out to his car and peel away down the alley.
Did you have any other paranormal experiences as a child or older? Have you ever seen a ghost, for example?
I don't really. I see dead people.
You do?
I don't really like the term ghost because it has such a bad connotation. I don't see lots of dead people. I don't really like to see dead people or to talk to dead people or have them talk to me, but I do. But not very often. And I think I always have known when there were ghosts in houses. I could pass houses when I was in the car and see which ones. I remember seeing, oh, that one has a ghost, and that one's haunted. What I guess I could deem a friendly ghost, and that's an
right.
unsettled ghost. I always consider them unsettled when they're not very happy.
Do they ever talk to you?
Dead people?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, but not in the way that live people talk to me. I get these messages, and they're just, it's information. You know, the only way I can think to explain it is I really believe that it's the historical speaking in tongues when mm-hmm. I give information, because my brain doesn't feel like it's giving the information. I feel like it's coming through my body, like my body is like a radio or a conduit for the information. So it's not like I actually hear someone's voice that has died. I just get the information and then it comes out of my mouth.
Okay.
But I really don't like dealing with dead people. It's just something I can do, like an
yeah.
artist.
Is it frightening or just unpleasant?
The murder cases are unpleasant, but I don't think it's any more unpleasant for me than it is for anybody else working on the case, any of the police detectives or the forensic people or the coroner. I don't think it's any more unpleasant for me than it is for them. It's a very unpleasant job to have to do. Am I afraid? No, I'm never afraid. And I think that it makes me feel sick, but I don't think it makes me feel any more sick than anybody else has, than, you know, an EMT or anybody that has to deal with things like that. It's mm-hmm. it's upsetting, but no more for me. But I'm really not afraid of anything. I used to be afraid of the dreams, but what's so wonderful is that since that 1993 dream, I don't have murder dreams anymore.
Mm-hmm. That was the last one.
That was the last one, and I've had them all my life. And so I think it's real important that I keep working on murder cases, because now my visions come during the day when I'm strong enough to deal with them, and I can have my nice, peaceful sleep.
What do you dream about now? Do you remember your dreams now?
Fun things, vacations, old boyfriends, just normal things, nothing. I don't have... Once in a while, I'll wake up with my jaw clenched and not quite know what it is, but it's usually just nothing, just nebulous dreams mm-hmm. with nothing that really means anything. Just worry dreams, you know, that old... I have a few of those dreams, like you're late for something. I constantly have this dream that I'm getting ready to go on vacation and I can't find the clothes to pack and I'm going to miss the plane. Just those dreams.
Mm-hmm.
That people, you know,
typical anxiety have. Dreams.
Yeah, anxiety dreams, right. But I don't have those murder dreams anymore. I'm so thrilled.
So, again, we are talking to Jan Ellen McGee. Evan, go ahead. You had a question for her?
Yeah, Jan Helen. So you mentioned other, well, or you at least alluded that that you've worked on some other murder cases. How many have you worked on?
Well, it's really hard to say because until just recently, I would just work on them and really not pay too much attention. I would say probably as much, I work on them until I run out of energy. So maybe 3 to 6 murder cases a year since 93. Yeah, mm-hmm. since 1993.
What sort of successes have you experienced with those cases?
Frankly, I'm not sure, because what happens is I work on the case and I tell all the information and then I just walk out of the room and don't ever contact the police again, and I don't even care or find out. The only reason I found out about this case was because Paul Zechman was on a show called The FBI Files on the Palmyra murder from this murder I had worked on previously. And after he finished filming that for New Dominion Pictures, they asked him if he knew of any psychics. And he told them about me, but said that I'm very private and that he would call me. And when he did, I said, mm-hmm. you know, Paul, of course not. I've kept this a secret. I don't want to talk to anybody, especially not television. And then there was silence, and I go, oh, you want me to do this, right? And he said, I think you should, because he knew that what one of my goals is to teach law enforcement how to use their psychic ability, how to, there's physical manifestations that we all have, that all mm-hmm. psychics have, and I think that they can be pinpointed, that they can pinpoint psychics within law enforcement. So he said, you know, this will get you what you want. So
right.
then he told me, that's the only reason I know about this case.
Sure. Oh, I'm just curious if you're curious at all about your, you know, what could be deemed a rate of success as far as your psychic visions go into how they actually turn out.
Well,
would you venture a guess maybe in a percentage of how often
I'd say 100.
They're accurate?
I say 100. Now, that doesn't mean that I solve every single case.
No.
But like one time I worked on a robbery. I seldom work on robberies, but I remember early on, it probably was 1994, I worked on a robbery and I called a cold call to a cop mm-hmm. and he just flat out told me this was ridiculous, and I told him, I don't know how it can harm you to write down what I say so I can get this out of my brain. So he did, and a year mm-hmm. later he called me back, apologetic, and telling me every single thing I said was true, and he's so sorry, and he doesn't know why he acted like such a jerk. Other police, there's been cases that I've worked on that I know aren't solved, but part of it, I think, is that they didn't follow my advice. Paul Zechman trusted me, and he did what I told him to do. And so if I give my information and the police do not do what I suggest, then it's not going to get solved. So as far as I'm concerned, I think my information is 100%. It's one of the few times in life I'm right.
Now, can you turn your attention to a case and come up with information, or can you choose the cases, in other words, or do they choose you?
A little bit of both. Most of the time I'll pick up the newspaper or I'll see something on the television, and then I'll say, oh, no, that's not the way it went. Or I'll know something, and then I'll just call. Sometimes I've been called by police all over the state and even out of state for help, and then I can just work on that case. Occasionally, I don't know anything at all, but mostly I have something to go on.
What do you think of other psychic detectives?
I think most psychics are scam psychics. And
see, most of them are not genuine.
How do they work? How do their scams work?
You know, I think it's just like any other scam. Are you men scientists?
Some of us.
All right.
Some by trade, other by interest.
Yeah, by trade or interest, right. So
right.
You have scientific thinking. So
yes.
You know scam scientists. Mm-hmm. There's scams in every walk of life, and they all work the same. They're very smart in that area, and they use tricks, and they BS.
So it's intentional, because sometimes it could be intentional, other times it could be more of a self-delusion, thinking they might think that they might not be intentionally scamming. But sometimes they do. So you come across all different types.
Exactly, but I don't think
right.
it's any different from any other scam, whether it's a scam lawyer or
right.
somebody says they're an FBI man and they're scamming some girl. No matter what it is, you use the exact same trick.
So how can we tell the difference between the scam psychic detectives and the genuine psychic detectives?
Well, I'm coming out with a book that's called Psychic Search. Don't get scammed. And really, frankly, the book is over 100 pages of all the different ways that you have to go about to not get scammed. I think that it's just the same as a doctor. You need to find references. In my case, no police detective has ever worked with me without calling my references.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a profiler, which, a profiler. A profiler,
yeah.
There's only two profilers in the state of Pennsylvania that I know of. And one of them vouches for me. And then Paul Zechman always vouches for me. But I have a whole long list now. But before, I always used the two of them. So the one thing is to find references. I think that you have to use your instinct and your intellect if you're using a psychic, because if you're, like, I was at the Hershey Hotel and sat down next to a psychic, and she told me, just everything she told me was wrong, and it was clearly wrong. So I knew right away that she wasn't accurate. I mean, if she says six things, none of which are accurate, then there, I can see right there. I think you can't let yourself get hoodwinked, and
Well, we certainly agree with that.
Right.
Yeah, it's just like any other scam person. You take their information, you check out their credentials, and
well, what would a credential be though? Like in this field, I mean, there really aren't any credentials because there's no gold standard. I mean, that begs the question that, of course, we're interested in as scientists and skeptics is, how do we know if this phenomenon is even genuine at all, from a scientific point of view, not necessarily as sort of a personal point of view, but just in the abstract?
Well, I think most psychics are scam psychics. And as far as proof, do you love someone? Do you love someone?
Of course I do, and I.
But can you prove it?
Well, that is not a scientific claim. You know, if you make a claim about the facts of nature, that requires science. making a claim about a subjective feeling is just completely different. So you really can't compare the two.
This is a subjective feeling.
But you have tangible. You are claiming tangible results, though, right?
But there are tangible results to love.
Yeah, but the two types of claims are not comparable in terms of that analogy that you're trying to draw. Either a phenomenon is real or it isn't real. And if it's real, then there needs to be manifestations that can be objectively determined. So, I mean, it sounds like, are you making the argument that there's no way science can ever validate your abilities?
Yes.
And why is that? Why would it be impossible to validate your abilities if they're real?
I think you can validate my results.
Well,
just like you can validate the results of love. Love makes you feel wonderful. Love makes you kinder, more caring. And so you can go to Paul Zeckman, a man who is the chief county detective in this town, a man who has had stakes his reputation on his good work, a man that you will see on the television show is a conservative, careful, slow-moving man, and he will tell you that I enabled him to find his murderer.
And, you know, we, of course, accept the fact that he probably believes that. And, again, you knew coming in that we were skeptics and that...
Oh, I don't mind.
And basically, our interpretation of all of this, I think, is a little bit different. I don't think... And we don't necessarily question people's motives or beliefs, because we can't read people's minds, so we don't know what people really think or believe. All our interest is on the tangible, verifiable results. We do know, and just from experience with many, many different, you know, paranormal phenomenon, that it is the capacity for people to be fooled by themselves, by events, is enormous. And the purpose of science is to essentially control for the vast human tendency to deceive ourselves. So let me ask you a question. If we wanted to subject you to some very basic common sense controls to see if we could validate the results of your investigations, would you be willing to do that?
If I felt that I would be willing to do anything that was moving forward for good. I would absolutely refuse to have to try to pick numbers or to try to make guesses, because my gift is not here to tell anybody something they already know.
Right.
My gift is to find out what people don't know.
Well, let me give you an example. Let me give you an example.
Then I'll tell you the way I think you should test me.
Sure, absolutely. When you get involved with a new case, the only thing that we would need to do would be to record all of the information that you produce about the case before the investigation reaches its conclusion, and then in some sort of objective way compare what you predicted to what was actually discovered. That's all. It's very, very straightforward.
Sure. I mean, you can do national cases as far as I'm concerned. Every time there's a national case, you can call me and I can tell you if I know something and where we go, or you can just pick a case. You can find a case where you live. You don't have to tell me hardly anything. You can find an unsolved murder case and we can see if we can go down that avenue.
That's great. You know, I think that would be very instructive. And if your goal is to promote the use of psychic detectives and to teach people how to use them correctly, this is the way to do it, in my opinion, because you could silence us, you could silence all the skeptics with verifiable data, because that's really all we're asking for. In fact, you know, we screen applicants for the Randy's $1 million psychic challenge, and we could do this as a screening test.
Right, because I don't want to. I really don't like the way he does things, because I just don't see how that's to humankind's good.
Well, donate the money to charity, but you could do whatever you want with it. But the point is, it's a very public, undeniable test.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the money. I just don't want to do a test that is just not for the public good. Because this, when I do these any kind of work in this way, it takes a huge amount of energy.
Yeah, I understand.
And when I work on a murder case, I often physically get ill. So if I'm going to do this and take this energy to try to, because I really don't have any interest in proving it to anyone.
I understand.
It just is. But I will be glad to work on more murder cases.
That's great. But, yeah, all we would ask is that you do what you're doing anyway. Do the cases that you're going to do anyway, but we'll just verify them in a way that doesn't leave any room for guesswork, that we know that we can measure in a scientific way the accuracy of the predictions that you make. We will allow you to set the parameters any way you want to, as long as it allows for some objective observation and conclusions at the end.
Jen Helen, you said you were going to give us a suggestion about how to test you. Out of curiosity, how would you test yourself?
Exactly like you said. I would like to work on murder cases, and you go ahead and find out how much of my information is accurate.
Okay.
That's great.
In basic agreement. That's good.
That's great. So we definitely would like to do that, because I think, it wasn't our purpose to debate with you here tonight. We really wanted to hear your experience, your side of the story.
Another thing that I can do is that if you physically put 10 people in front of me, I can probably tell you what's physically wrong with all 10 of them.
You can make like medical diagnoses?
That's very testable.
I'm not a medicine person, but I can see what's wrong with them, what part of their body is weak, has a weakness. So you could ask all 10 people what was wrong with them in advance, and you could test, see
give
that.
Give me an example of the kind of statement that you would make. You said what part of the body
usually,
is that work?
It usually just comes out with your right hip hurts.
Okay, something like that, your right hip hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mention specific diseases, like you have diabetes,
kind
of thing?
No,
more.
I'm not that accurate, because I'm not a medical person.
Yeah, just more basic symptoms?
No, I can usually just see if it's bone, muscle, or blood. I can also see if it's inherited or if it was an injury.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, that's a lot more easy to test than going through an entire, say a murder case, an investigation, and following it to its conclusion, and then doing a comparison.
Yeah, well, that would be another.
That
would be an easier test to do.
Two different tests.
But I think we should do both. I mean, because they're different kinds of tests.
And frankly, I just think I get a lot more power on the murder stuff. But I just know that that's one other thing that I'm good at.
Jen Helen, do you have to be in the room with the person in order to see what's wrong with them, or do you do it from afar? Or you have to be in a close proximity?
With the health problems, I usually like to be in a room with the person. With the murder cases, I often start on the phone, but then when it starts to get upsetting, I usually like to be with a police officer. So I'm just wondering how that's going to go. But, if we get to that point, there's no reason why you couldn't, if there was a case, there's no reason why I couldn't also talk to the police officer, and possibly they would let you be there or have me continue with them. If it gets to that point, we'd want to continue and at least pass off my information to a detective.
Is there an average amount of time, Jen Helen, that it takes to work on a murder case? Is it a number of hours, days?
Usually I have three different meetings. The first meeting, I make the cold call. Then I type things into my computer and send them. Then the next thing is usually the police has me come in, and I go through more information. The detective might have maybe three questions. I usually tell them not to talk at all. I don't like them to talk about anything. Mm-hmm. And occasionally I have a question, like why couldn't the victim get out of the bed? And I remember that they said because the victim was in a wheelchair, so he couldn't run away from the problem. But then usually I go to the site, the murder site. So that's about it.
I see.
Four different times, and it can be maybe 2 to 4 hours when I meet them. Maybe 2 hours at the meeting, and a couple hours to go to the murder site, and maybe drive by some other area that where maybe something to do with the crime that the police officer wants to show me. And the initial meeting on the phone, that's just pretty brief, and then I send out my information that I type up, and that's I usually write 1 to 2 full pages. And then when I call again, then we schedule a meeting, because usually as a result of what I've written, I have so much accuracy that then they schedule a meeting with me.
Do you ever encounter
nobody could know.
Do you ever encounter police who are hostile to working with you?
Of course.
Don't want to hear what you have to say, hang up,
etc. Almost all of them. Almost all of them don't want to hear what I have to say. That, you know, because there are a lot of scam psychics call them, and a lot of them have never worked with anybody like me before, but I have a Master of Arts degree, and I'm a music teacher, and I have a reputation to uphold, and I have really good references, and so, pretty much a good detective, though, is always going to listen to anything someone tells them. They might not go on for the 6 to 8 hours it takes to talk to me, but they're sure going to take the information, briefly at least. But then once I tell them things that nobody knows, then they all go further with me.
Jen Helen, it was a pleasure to have you on The Skeptic's Guide. Thank you for sharing all of that with us. I look forward to working with you in the future. It sounds like we have an agreement that you will do a investigate a murder case under our observation, so we can basically tally your accuracy. We'll be in touch off the air with the details for that. But that is excellent. I'm looking forward to doing that.
Try to pick the victim being a male instead of a female.
Victim a male. Whatever. Any details you want, we'll do. We always try to design these
but
to accommodate the claimant as much as possible.
Just disregard that. I'll do anybody.
Okay.
It's all right.
But we want you to feel as comfortable as possible. Whatever details we'll make you.
Well, I like when they're bad guys.
Bad guys.
But you don't have to find bad guys killing bad guys. Okay. Whatever you want to do, I'll do any cases because it's real important to me to help society as much as I possibly can.
Excellent.
Great. Well, thanks again.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
So that was our first interview with a non-skeptic. It was quite interesting. What did you guys think of Jan Helen?
Oh, I thought she was very lively. I think she's very interesting. And, of course, the thing I take away from this is her agreement to be tested.
Absolutely.
By the New England Skeptical Society.
That's going to be the only way to get anything meaningful out of this in terms of scientifically. I mean, her claims are so glowing. She thinks she has 100%
accuracy. 100%
accuracy.
Well,
that's
what she said.
Yeah, when you start saying that your predictions, if they didn't come true, they will in the future in some indefinite time, then you can easily believe that. Hey, I'm 100%. You know, I never make a mistake if you leave it wide open to the future.
Yeah, but Bob, remember she said in the interview when she deals with these murder cases, she's looking only into the past. So it has happened. She claimed 100% accuracy to that with no pleading to any future predictions.
Yeah, I think you guys are both referring to comments she made to us
when
we weren't recording. But she did say she can. When she makes predictions, sometimes there are predictions of the future, and that's why they may not be true at that moment. But when she does do her murder cases, she's always looking into the past. But we will propose to her two tests, actually. The simple one will be for her to, she can basically detect medical symptoms or ailments, you know, on people. She did it for us over the phone, in fact. That'll be very easy to test. And then the next time we have a viable murder case that's, you know, regionally convenient, geographically convenient, then we again just need to get her to list all of her predictions ahead of time before the details of the case are known, and then we'll compare that list to whatever details eventually come to light point by point. She won't get to pick and choose or morph them to fit, you know, what ultimately happens, or just remember the hits and forget the misses. So it'll be instructive, and as usual, the most instructive thing will be how she responds after the test is completed, but we will see. We did get her to agree to a test. So stay tuned for her.
Not only did she agree, she seemed eager.
She seemed eager. She clearly, my impression is that she really believes that in her abilities. I got a little bit of a sense of a fantasy prone personality from some of the history that she gave. So I think she's probably sincere.
I don't doubt that.
She does a little bit of a cold reading when she sits down with the detectives. To glean some of the details of the case, and you know, she works with detectives who believe in her ability, so that makes cold reading really easy when you're dealing with a subject who is predisposed to believing, you know, in your abilities. But again, sitting here, all we can do is speculate. We need to gather some firsthand information, and we'll do that. We tried to bait her with $1 million. Again, she didn't seem too eager about that. That's actually a little bit of a red flag, you know. And I would think that if someone genuinely believed in their own powers, especially if they think that they're 100%, that they would be most eager to snatch up that $1 million.
I have never heard anybody with a paranormal claim of any kind say anything good about Randy's challenge.
Right.
Right.
Never. Well, he doesn't do it right. He sets it up. She can't win. They hate it. They hate him and they hate it.
Yeah, what they don't realize
because what he does is scientifically accurate.
Right. It makes him look so bad. I mean, think about it. I mean, that's such a huge thing that he's willing to give anyone $1 million.
Right. And folks, just so you know, what he wants you to do in your application for the $1 million challenge is state what you can do and with what degree of success. And that's basically all the information he's looking for. And most of the applicants cannot answer those questions. And,
right.
And they cannot put it into a cohesive statement.
Right. But we'll do that. I mean, I've made up several protocols now to screen, you know, applicants for that. And it's a negotiation. It's a discussion back and forth, you know, to get them to sort of coalesce their claims into something tangible and to come up with, you know, a way to score it and a threshold for what we would consider to be success. One guy, it was interesting, wasn't sure why we weren't going to use a p-value of 0.05, which basically means a 1 in 20 chance of having a positive result by random chance alone. It's like, well, you know, Randy can't give $1 million to every 20th person that he tests, you know, with the psychic challenge. But anyway, so we'll do that. If she wants to do the, you know, we could screen her, you know, for the Randy challenge. And if she passes, we'll be happy to pass her along to Randy. But no one apparently has ever gotten through the screening phase of the challenge. So again, we'll definitely follow up on this in the future. We also have been in discussions with the detective on this particular case. You know, he may or may not come on the show on a future episode, but we'll at least talk to him about the case and see if we can get some further details. He was not available for tonight. Well, guys, it was another fun episode. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Steve.
Our pleasure, as usual.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kenno and is used with permission.
That's last theorem. Let him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays. Oh,